Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Then someone called the police finally came. Wrote a couple of tickets, took a couple of lines in the parking lot.
From newsounds.org, it's time for another live in-studio performance in our series, The Soundcheck Podcast, streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. I'm John Schaefer. Steve Earle has been many things, a multiple Grammy Award-winning musician, an actor, a writer, a political activist, but he's also a music fan. Specifically, he's a fan of two of the late great Texas songwriters, Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark. Now, 10 years ago, Steve recorded an album called Townes, which was devoted to Van Zandt's music. Now it's Guy Clark's turn. Steve Earle and the Dukes have a new album called Simply Guy. It includes versions of 16 of Guy Clark's songs, and it brings Steve Earle back to our studio. He's going to start us off with Dublin Blues.
I wish I was in Austin, in the chiller parlor bar, drinking Mad Dog margaritas and not caring where you are. But here I am in Dublin, just rolling cigarettes, holding back and choking back the shakes with every breath. So forgive me all my anger, give me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I love you from the get-go, I'll love you till I die. I love you on the Spanish steps the day you say goodbye. Now I'm just a poor boy, works my middle name. If money was a reason, then I wouldn't be the same. I'll stand up and be counted, I'll face up to the truth. I can walk away from trouble, but I can't walk away from you. So forgive me all my anger, forgive me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I love you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I loved you on the Spanish steps the day you said goodbye. I've been to Fort Worth, I've been to Spain, I've been too proud to come in out of the rain. I've seen the David, seen the Mona Lisa too. I've heard Doc Watson play Columbus Stockade Blues. So forgive me all my anger, forgive me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I love you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I love you on the Spanish steps the day you say goodbye. I wish I was in Austin, in the chiller parlor bar, drinking Mad Dog margaritas and not caring where you are.
Dublin Blues, live performance from Steve Earle, solo here in our studio, a song by the great Texas songwriter Guy Clark, and the lead-off track from the new album by Steve Earle and the Dukes called Simply Guy. Steve, good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
So, you know, we all have friends who've been such a part of our lives that we can't even remember the first time we met them.
Right.
But then most of us have friends where that initial meeting is forever burned into our memories.
Yeah.
Which was Guy for
you? You know, the latter. And both Guy and Towns, because I went looking for both of them. I went to Houston looking for Towns when I was 17, and I went looking to Nashville looking for Guy when I was 19.
How hard was he to find?
Towns took a while because he didn't live anywhere, and I had to wait for him to come back around to Houston. I'd been in the same room with him once in Austin before that. Jerry Jeff Walker's 33rd birthday party, I crashed it. But I finally met him at the old quarter in Houston. I just had to wait for him to come to town. I knew where he hung out, but he had a house in the country by the time I moved to Nashville in November of 74. And I walked in one night to Bishop's Pub, and Richard Dobson, who's not with us anymore, is a great songwriter in his own right, was tending bar, and he said, "Guy's here. He's in the back." And, you know, so I went in the back, and Guy was shooting pool, him and Susanna, his wife, and who's quite a songwriter herself and a great painter. And then Jim Stafford and Deborah Allen, and they were shooting pool. And I was, you know, I just kind of had this cowboy hat that nobody would have recognized me without at the time. Just a black Bull Rider blocked, you know, Americans, the brand name, you know, AAA hat, kind of what everybody wore that I knew. And I just kind of had it pulled down low over my eyes and got back in the corner, tried to be inconspicuous and wait for an opening. And he was lining up a shot, and I just happened to be, I wasn't in his way, but I was in his line of vision. Mm-hmm. And he just sort of looked up through those eyebrows and he said, "Nice hat." And that kind of started the conversation. And he found out very quickly that I knew Towns. And so that I started getting invited to stuff. And it was the beginning of a real live, you know, it was a friendship, but it also was, and I'm very fortunate, it was a real live old world style apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And I benefited from that greatly.
So how does that work with something as elusive as songwriting? I mean, what did you learn from Guy?
And when Guy a lot directly. I mean, Towns was like, give you a copy of Bury My Heart at Windsor and tell you to go read it and tell you to put the cap back on the bottle or somebody to kick it over, which was useful information in my life at the time. But Guy would show me how he laid a song out on paper so that, you know, number the lines so that, you know, I knew how many lines I had in the first verse, and so go down and number the second verse so you know what the blanks you're filling in are, sort of mathematically. And then showed me how to notice what I did in the first verse that was pure inspiration, which was sometimes like complicated internal rhyme schemes that came to me, you know, naturally. But then when you don't do it in the second verse, your second verse is never going to be as good. So he said, "No, now you need to get your second verse to poetically live up to your first verse." And he showed me, he saw me writing with a pen one day and said, "What are you doing? Write with a pencil, with a big eraser." And he told me songs are never finished until you play them for people.
Yeah.
Because we were singer-songwriters. We were taking money from publishing companies, kind of under false pretenses, but we weren't there to write, you know, the next
for other people,
next Ronnie Millsap single. That was not what we were there for.
Although, ironically, a lot of Guy's big hits were not his own recordings. They were other
people. No, I mean, the biggest hits he had were other people. I don't think he ever got, you know, above the, maybe the 60s or 70s, maybe slightly higher than that with his own records on the country charts, and never got on the pop charts at all. You know, he had Ricky Skaggs, one of the biggest records. Parking Lot that you play coming, that's one of the biggest records that he had. It was pretty late in his career. So I included songs like that, but we were the same kind of writer naturally. We were story songwriters, and so there was a lot I could learn from him. And so I paid a lot of attention to it. And he was, the other thing he did was if you've ever seen Heartworn Highways, that documentary about that period in Nashville and Austin, there's a scene where it's actually in the outtakes that they've added to this deluxe version, but it's Christmas Eve at Guy and Susanna's house. He's getting me to play this song I just written called The Mercenary Song, which I didn't record till years later, but he's telling everybody around the table, it's like Steve Young and I think Billy Joe Shaver's there, a couple of other people, and he says, listen to this song. He got me my publishing deal. He went to his publisher and harassed him until he finally signed me.
So your two kind of musical lodestars, Towns Van Zandt, Guy Clark, were they friends?
Oh, they were best friends.
They
unconditional
were. Okay.
Best friends until Towns passed away.
Okay. Then the three of you did a live record back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I know the date of that because it was September 13th, 1995. It was my first sobriety anniversary just by happenstance. And So I hadn't been, you know, out of jail and sober very long. And, you know, it was just the three of us. And it was a fundraiser for a dental care for indigents organization that Susanna Clark worked with. And so she's the one that got us into it. And you know, they made it into that Live at the Bluebird record. And it was a trip. It was the last time the three of us were all in the same room together. Because we were all on the road so much, it just didn't never, all three of us never happened again.
So let me ask you, I mean, obviously you've thought through this because you've done the Towns record 10 years ago, but how do you find your own way into a body of work of someone that, you know, you admired so much, learned so much from, and in Guy's case, where there are sort of other authoritative versions of these songs, like the Jerry Jeff Walker, the Ricky Skaggs, that you have to deal with?
But first off, I went with the stuff that I knew and the stuff that I was most emotionally connected to. A couple of things I made, you know, I wasn't as much. Parking Lot I did because it was later, it was a big hit, and I wanted to get some, I had to kind of work to get later stuff in because my connection to him, you know, closely was early. I was, you know, around when his first record came out. I sang on one song on it. I played bass with him on the very first tour that he did. And so those are the songs I was most connected to. Most of those songs I knew by heart. I didn't have to put a piece of paper in front of me to sing them. On both the Towns record and the Guy record, I played these things as close to the way I remember those guys playing them as I possibly could. Jerry Jeff's version of L.A. Freeway is very different than Guy's. And I love that version, but when I heard Guy sing it, you know, which wasn't until I got to Nashville, because his first record didn't come out until a year after I got there, I knew, I was very much aware of that song, very much aware of who he was. But hearing him do it, I went, oh, that's the singer-songwriter part. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the Jerry Jeff version, and I'm sure it was a financial pleasure. But it's not, as Kinky Friedman says, but it's not like,
it's still, that sounds
there's
like a
there's
Kinky
a thing Friedman. About a song like that, especially a personal song as L.A. Freeway is, when you hear the person that wrote it sing it, it's something special. Yeah. You know, 'cause this job is empathy. People don't care about what I feel or what Guy feels. They care about what we feel that they can relate to, that, right. that connects to something that happens in their life. And everybody with Guy, we were opposites in that respect, too. I talk all the time. He was very quiet. He didn't like big cities, and I do, you know. And I've been running to them all my life. In L.A., he lived there but kind of by accident. You know, he started a guitar shop in San Francisco, and he just went down to L.A. when that came apart. You know, he got signed to his publishing deal out there, but he wanted to live in Nashville, and they asked him where he wanted to live, and he moved to Nashville. And I think L.A. Freeway was one of the first things that he wrote after he got there.
And Jerry Jeff Walker had the sort of hit version of the song.
Yeah, they knew each other back to the late 60s when Jerry Jeff would come to Houston to play The Jester and Sand Mountain, which was a coffee house. Mr. Bojangles has written in an apartment above Sand Mountain Coffee House that was actually Towns's apartment. And Jerry Jeff would come through and crash there, and that's where Mr. Bojangles was written. So there was a connection between Jerry Jeff and Gary B. White, who was the bass player in Circus Maximus, Jerry Jeff's first band, who was from Houston. That's how Jerry Jeff realized there was a little scene in Houston. And he was sort of, Jerry Jeff's whole MO in those days was to travel as much as possible and not stay around long enough to wear out his welcome. That's kind of what he did.
And he's on the record with you.
I had to have Jerry Jeff there. And had to have Terry Allen, because after Towns was gone, they were probably best friends. And there's a lot of other people there. Mickey Raphael, you know, Rodney Crowell, Emmy, you know.
Emmy Lou Harris.
One old friends, yeah.
Yep. So. Well, it's just you and the guitar here in the studio today. You want to do L.A. Freeway?
No, we'll flip it.
I
know
right,
we talked about it a lot, but I have a little, well, I'm not going to. The last time I saw Guy, I was, he was in a rehab center because he'd gone through some chemo and they were trying to get him home, which they did a few days later. And my routine had become, you know, go to Nashville, see my mom, see Guy, do whatever I had to do. Then on my way out, see my mom, see Guy. And because he wasn't touring anymore, so I couldn't run into him on the road. And somebody decided it'd be a nice thing to do to bring him some barbecue. And he, you know, I got there late because I'd been at my mom's first and the barbecue was gone and Guy was asleep. So I said hi and bye to everybody. I felt like I needed to. Then I was on my way out the door, and just as I got to the door, Guy's eyes pop open, and he said, "Steven." And I said, "Don't even think about it, because nobody else ever called me that." And he and I said, "Hey, man, how was that barbecue?" And he said, "Pork." Because 44 years of living in Tennessee, Guy Clark never accepted pork as proper barbecue. So the last thing that my teacher said to me was, pork. and that was totally okay because it was so Guy.
So you're going to do Desperado's Waiting for a Train, which is one of his, in my opinion, one of his all-time great songs. And here's Steve Earle.
I'd play the Red River Valley. He'd sit in the kitchen and cry, run his fingers to 7 years of living. One of the largest every well I drilled gone dry. His friends, me and this old man, like desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. He's a drifter and driller of all wells, an old school man of the world. Taught me how to drive his car when he's too drunk to, so then he'll wink and give me money for the girls. And our lives like some old Western movie, like desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. From the time of life could walk to take me with him to a park called the Green Frog Cafe. There were old men with beer guts and dominoes, lying about their lives while they played. And I was just a kid called a psychic, like this. Desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. One day I looked up and he's pushing 80, round the back of stains all down his chin. He's one of the heroes of this country. Why is he all dressed up like them old men? Drinking beer, playing Moon and 42, like desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. The day before he died, I went to see him. I was grown, he's almost gone. So we closed the eyes and dreamed us up a kitchen. Sang another verse to that old song. So come on, Jack, son of a bitch is coming on. Like desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train. Desperados waiting for a train.
Steve Earle, live here in our New York studio on this edition of the Soundcheck podcast from newsounds.org. And another song by Guy Clark, Desperados Waiting for a Train. You'll find a version with the full band, with the Dukes, on the new album called Simply Guy. Comes out on Friday. And you mentioned, Steve, that Guy had a guitar shop up in the Bay Area for a while.
Right. He and a guy named Minor Wilson moved out there and opened it up. And somebody sent me a picture recently, a guitar player from the Bay Area, just heard I was making this record. And I do Hardly Strictly Bluegrass there every year. And somehow he tracked me down and sent me a picture of Guy, Minor, and this guitar player, Tom, and Bobby Weir, like in 1969, sitting in front of the shop.
Wow.
And it's, you know, they were a guitar repair shop. They didn't sell guitars. They worked on guitars. And
he was like a luthier.
Oh, no, he built guitars, beautiful guitars. He built classical guitars originally, he and Minor did. And then that business, you know, didn't fly. So Guy went south to L.A. He worked at the Dobro factory. He set necks for the Dopero brothers at the Dobro factory in Orange County. And then he moved to Nashville, and then he worked on all our guitars when I first got there to town. I had several guitars that he worked on over the years.
So what are you playing today?
What, this guitar?
Yeah, this guitar.
This is, kind of one of my road guitars. They're all M-size Martins, which are, I don't know, for guitar nerds, that's one size bigger than the triple O-size guitar. It's a 16-inch guitar, but it's not the big, deep dreadnought thing. I still, when I play with the bluegrass band, I use a dreadnought-size Martin, but for playing all night, every night, usually when I'm playing live, I'm using a pickup anyway, and I can add bass electronically. And I figured out that ergonomically, it was just sort of kicking my butt to play that great big guitar, you know, because it puts your arms in a more awkward position. So it's a little easier to control, and they're great sounding guitars.
Did Guy work on any of your, you got two here in the studio.
Not only the ones that I have now, because the ones he worked on were guitars I owned in the 70s, and any guitar I had in the 70s and 80s went in my arm, and I started all over again in the 90s.
Yeah. Steve Earle with us on this edition of the podcast. Let me read something from the liner notes that you wrote. Now he's gone, speaking about Guy Clark, now he's gone, and when I follow him, because I always have, I'll leave this world with only one regret, and that is that I never wrote a song with Guy Clark.
Right.
How did that not happen?
Well, you know, I'm not a co-writer very often. I do it, but I do it for specific reasons with certain people. Neither one of us were originally. In fact, Guy was one of the things he taught me was co-writing is a waste of time. But we both got older. You know, he also didn't tell me I shouldn't use a rhyme dictionary at Thesaurus when we were both younger. But I found out later he had been using one for years and I'd been using one for years. And we finally kind of, you know, came clean to each other about that. But, you know, it's just that he asked me to. He said, we should write a song. At the end of his life, he was writing with all these younger writers just to keep writing. You know, the difference between Towns and Guy is like the difference between Kerouac and Ginsberg. It's largely discipline and, you know, 20 more years on the planet because of discipline is part of it. I mean, Guy wasn't an angel, but he, you know, he didn't get into trouble quite as quickly as Towns did or as deeply as Towns did with that kind of stuff. And he just wrote every day. He was very workman about it. And he had to find a way to keep writing, and co-writing is how he did it, getting in with younger people, and he wrote some great songs. Parking Lot's one of them. But that were Daryl Scott, and so when he asked me, I planned to do it, and it just never happened because I don't live there anymore, and it never came together. It never happened, and I'm not big on regrets because they're not good for people like me in recovery, but that one's tough. That one's tough to shake because I have to take responsibility for it. He couldn't go anywhere. I needed to get my butt there, and I didn't do it. So
well, he lived, as you say, a much longer life than Towns Van Sant.
20 years, 22 years.
But still, when the end came for Guy Clark, it came pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, we were surprised, I guess, because he had had cancer for over 10 years, and then then his health deteriorated really quickly. But a lot of that was heart disease that brought about by years and years of chemo, because that's what it does. And he never did quit smoking. You know, he quit drinking only when chemo made it impossible for him to drink anymore, which was several years before he passed away. And, you know, he smoked cigarettes and smoked other things, and he didn't do everything the doctors told him to do. Mm-hmm. But he was tough. And he just kept himself working. That's the main thing that he did about it, was he kept, you know, trying to find a way to write songs.
Well, that idea that you...
He started building guitars again, too, after not building any for 20 years. And he built about, I don't know, maybe 19, 20 guitars.
Wow.
And
where are they?
Some people have one. Everybody that knows him, that's close to him, has one except me, I think. And I don't know. I think he intended for me to have one, but... Just another one of those things. I wasn't there all the time. One day I tried, you know, I collect guitars. I'm pretty famous for it. And I said, Guy, I want to buy one of your guitars. And he said, won't sell you one. Might give you one. And, you know, that's the kind of sentences the guy spoke in. He wrote a lot of times because he didn't talk very much. And there were two witnesses. And I think people that speak fluent, Guy Clark, agree that that was his intention, was to give me a guitar, but it just never happened, so I don't have one.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea that the creative process can also be a discipline, that, you know, you don't just sit around and wait for inspiration to strike
that's
you,
what it is. That's what I learned from him and Susanna. These things that artists do are called disciplines for a reason. No one's going to tell you when to punch a clock. So if you don't, you know, find a way to discipline yourself to do it, you know, then it's not going to happen. And it'll stop happening entirely eventually. It happened to me. I finally took enough drugs that I didn't write anything for 4.5 years because it was a full-time, you know, job just to support my drug habit. So, and as soon as I got sober, I wrote Goodbye. And then I kept writing after that. So it's just... To write songs at the level of art, we were post-Bob Dylan songwriters, and that's how we thought of ourselves. We were making art. That's where the bar was. So Susanna was one of the major arbiters of whether it was art or not, because she was a fine artist. She painted, and she painted beautifully. And so she was the person we were always trying to impress when we wrote new songs and gotten around playing them for each other.
Mm-hmm. She would appear with him, right?
She never really performed. I don't think I ever saw her perform. Maybe once or twice saw her sing, you know, Black Haired Boy or something, early on. And then
there's some photos or videos.
Yeah,
or...
it's in you know, Heartworn Highways, in that documentary, I think there's some footage of her singing. But she just she had no desire to perform. She wanted to write and paint. And I wish she'd painted more, actually, to tell you the truth. I was always kind of hard on her because she didn't paint, because she painted her stuff. Have you ever seen the cover of Quarter Moon, 10 Cent Town, that Emmylou Harris record? You know, that dark background. It's a dark sky with, you know, Easy From Now, and it's a line from that song, which Susanna wrote. And that the cover's beautiful, but that's a painting of Susanna's. And that painting of a shirt hanging on the wall on the cover of Old Number One, that's a painting of Susanna's as well.
Okay. Your next record will have one of your own paintings on the cover.
It's actually, it's a single, a 7-inch coming out for Record Store Day.
Yeah.
When I finished this record, I knew I was going to disappoint somebody, you know, and a lot of people, because there were 16 songs. And like I said, the difference between Kerouac and Ginsberg, I don't know if you've ever seen the complete poems of Allen Ginsberg, but it's a big book.
Oh, it's massive, yeah.
So there's no, you know, I knew I was going to disappoint somebody, but... Go to Hardly Strictly Bluegrass right after we finish the record, and Los Lobos rolls up in a van. Louis Perez gets out, and Louis's the lyricist, the principal lyricist in Lobos, a big Guy Clark fan. So he came over and said, I heard you did the Guy record. I said, yeah, we did. I said, did you record the Cape? And I said, no. He said, did you? And I wasn't that connected to the Cape. That was a choice. I knew people would want to hear it, but I just decided, you know, I can't do this justice because I'm not as connected to it as the other Psalms. I didn't. It just wasn't one that kind of got me. But and then he said, did you do El Coyote? And I should have done El Coyote. So I went into Electric Lady here in New York as soon as I got back, and I recorded two songs solo. Because I have to have something exclusive for Record Store Day every year. Record Store Day is important to me. These last of these mom-and-pop record stores out there, you know, there's more left in Europe. There's more left other places in the world. But here, there's some cities that don't have a record store at all. And so I think it's important to help them keep going. And we do an exclusive recording for Record Store Day every year. This year, it's a 7-inch with El Coyote on one side and an old song of guys that he never recorded, but Towns recorded it, called Don't Let the Sunshine Fool You. Towns' version is on the late, great Towns Van Zandt. And then normally Tony Fitzpatrick does my covers, and he has for a long time since I Feel All Right. But this time I decided for that, you know, to go ahead and do a cover myself. And so I did a a little painting that I did it on the road with what I had available on the bus, and it turned out pretty good. I'm pretty proud of it. El Coyote is the A side, so that the painting has to do with that.
Yeah, those are solo performances on this 7-inch, and of course you're doing solo. These songs, you know, while they're great with a band, they hold up.
We were writing songs that hold up on, you know, writing them on one guitar, and they hold up on one guitar. And I think, you know, like I said, they're not songs you play them for people. And we were all, you know, they come out of coffee houses. This whole little salon of songwriters that I hung out with in Nashville. Every one of us had come out of coffee houses at one point.
All right, you want to do L.A. Freeway for
sure.
us? All right, another Guy Clark song played live by Steve Earle.
Pack up all your dishes, maiden of all good wishes, say goodbye to the landlord phone man. Some bitches always bored me, throw out some old L.A. papers, molded box of vanilla wafer, adios to all this concrete. Gonna get me some dirt road back street. If I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught, I'll be down the road in a cloud of smoke to some land. I ain't Bob, 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 and it's his to you, old skinny Dennis. Only one I think I will miss, I can hear your basement singing, sweet and low like a gift you're bringing. Play it for me one more time now. Gotta give it all we can now, I believe every word you're saying. Just keep on, keep on playing. If I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught, I'll be down the road in a cloud of smoke to some land. I ain't Bob, 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 and you put the pink card in the mailbox. Leave the key in the old front door locked. They will find it likely as not. Sure, there's something we have forgot. Oh, Susanna, don't you cry, babe. Love's a gift to surely hand me. We got something to believe in. Don't you think it's time we're leaving? If I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught, I've been down the road in a cloud of smoke to some land. I am Bob, Bob, Bob. If I just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught. Pack up all your dishes, made a note of all good wishes, say goodbye to the landlord for me. Some bitches always bored me.
That is L.A. Freeway, written by Guy Clark, performed live by Steve Earle here in the studio. That was an early song by Guy Clark, and probably to this day, the only song I can think of that references Nilla Wafers.
Yeah, yeah. Like, one of those deals, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he did that thing about detail and thing about things for everyday life. That's what he did,
yeah.
And probably the greatest story song writer that ever lived, simply because he knew how to make you see the space in which the story's taking place.
But also the form you were talking about before, the structure, the architecture of the song,
sure.
You know, how many lines and the internal rhyming scheme and all
right.
that. And one thing that he probably got this from, like, the British and Appalachian folk traditions is the repetition of the first verse at the end of the song.
Yeah, he did it. He didn't do it all the time, but he did it sometimes.
Yeah.
He liked doing that. I've done it a few times over the years because he did it, but it's a device.
Right.
What happens is that you go, it becomes a loop in your brain and in your heart. That's what that device does.
Yeah. Steve Earle performing this summer, and you'll be here in the metropolitan area, sort of skirting New York, May 10th at the Newton Theater in Newton, New Jersey, Saturday, May 11th out on Long Island at the May Day Music Festival, and then Monday, May 13th up in Ridgefield, Connecticut at the Ridgefield Playhouse. And September is always Camp Copperhead, right?
Camp Copperhead, and which is moving to September. It was June for years. And we're moving it to basically around Labor Day this year. And we'll be announcing soon. You know, we have, you know, our whole lineup. But it's something I look forward to. And also...
It's like a songwriting camp.
It's a camp. It's yeah. It's a course that I teach, and there's other teachers, and... You know, some of the people that come are songwriters, and we've found a few people over the years. There's a girl named Roseanne Reed who came to our very first year, and she's become faculty since, and her first record's coming out this year. She's Scottish. It took me 3 years to figure this out, that I knew her father and I knew her uncle, because her father's Craig Reed, who's half of the Proclaimers.
And
I don't know why that didn't occur to me when she turned up 18 years old. Well, probably because she was 18 years old and sleeping in a pup tent, which blew down the first night, and some of the other girls took her in, but she's incredible. She writes really, really great songs, and she's a great singer. But there's other people that are never going to be songwriters, and I tell everybody I can't make you a songwriter if you aren't one already. But you can come, and if you're a songwriter, you'll be a better songwriter when you leave, I think. And if you're not, then you'll know more about how it's done.
Well, and maybe sort of passing on the knowledge that people like Towns and Guy
pass. There's a lot of Towns and Guy in it, because that's where I learned from.
Yeah.
Oh, also, John Henry's Friends will be the middle of December. We haven't locked the date in yet, but the benefit for the Keswell School, where my son John Henry attends, and that's usually our big show in New York City every year in the city proper.
Well, Steve, it's always great to have you here in our studios at WNYC. Congratulations on the new record on Guy.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
As always, keep your back to the sun. You can almost feel the weight of the gun. And it's faster than snakes or the blink of an eye. And it's a time for all slow men to die. And his eyes get squinty and his fingers twitch as he empties his gun at the son of a bitch. And he's hit by the smell of the black powder smoke. And the stand in the street at the turn of a joke. Hidden by the smell of the black powder smoke and the stand in the street at the turn of a joke.
That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Check us out at newsounds.org for other performances, in-studio videos, gig alerts, weekly music roundups, and more. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.
He's nobody's fool and the only one here who remembers the smell of the black powder smoke and the stand in the street at the turn of a joke. Remember the smell of the black powder smoke and the stand in the street.